man go leaping upward. That didn't matter now. There would be evidence. "What's going on?" the pilot asked, stopping breathlessly beside the seat. "He's torn up one of the engine plates," said Wilson in a shaking voice. "He's what?" "The man outside," said Wilson. "I tell you, he's..." "Mr. Wilson, keep your voice down," ordered the pilot. Wilson's jaw went slack. "I don't know what's going on here," said the pilot. "But will you look?" shouted Wilson. "Mr. Wilson, I'm warning you. For God's sake!" Wilson swallowed quickly, trying to repress the blinding rage he felt. Abruptly, he pushed back against his seat and pointed at the window with a palsied hand. "Will you, for God's sake, look?" he asked. Drawing in an agitated breath, the pilot bent over. In a moment, his gaze shifted coldly to Wilson's.
"Well?"
he asked. Wilson jerked his head around. The plates were in their normal position. "Oh, no, wait," he said before the dread could come. "I saw him pry that plate up." "Mr. Wilson, if you don't—" "I said I saw him pry it up," said Wilson. The pilot stood there looking at him in the same withdrawn, almost aghast way as the stewardess had. Wilson shuddered violently. "Listen, I saw him," he cried. The sudden break in his voice appalled him. In a second, the pilot was down beside him. "Mr. Wilson, please," he said. "All right, you saw him. But remember, there are other people aboard. We mustn't alarm them." Wilson was too shaken to understand at first.
You mean you've seen him, then?" he asked.
"Of course," the pilot said, "but we don't want to frighten the passengers. You can understand that."
Of course, I don't want to."
Wilson felt a spastic coiling in his groin and lower stomach. Suddenly, he pressed his lips together and looked at the pilot with malevolent eyes.
"I understand," he said. "The thing we have to remember," began the pilot.
"We can stop now," Wilson said.
"Sir?"
Wilson shuddered. "Get out of here," he said. "Mr. Wilson, what? Will you stop?" Face whitening, Wilson turned from the pilot and stared out at the wing, eyes like stone. He glared back suddenly. "Rest assured, I'd not say another word," he snapped. "Mr. Wilson, try to understand." Wilson twisted away and stared out venomously at the engine. From a corner of his vision, he saw two passengers standing in the aisle looking at him. Idiots. His mind exploded. He felt his hands begin to tremble, and for a few seconds was afraid that he was going to vomit. "It's the motion," he told himself. The plane was bucking in the air now like a storm-tossed boat. He realized that the pilot was still talking to him, and refocusing his eyes, he looked at the man's reflection in the window. Beside him, mutely somber, stood the stewardess. "Blind idiots, both of them," thought Wilson. He did not indicate his notice of their departure. Reflected on the window, he saw them heading toward the rear of the cabin. "They'll be discussing me now," he thought, "setting up plans in case I grow violent." He wished now that the man would reappear, pull off the cowling plate and ruin the engine. It gave him a sense of vengeful pleasure to know that only he stood between catastrophe and the more than 30 people aboard. If he chose, he could allow that catastrophe to take place. Wilson smiled, without humor. There would be a royal suicide, he thought. The little man dropped down again, and Wilson saw that what he thought was correct. The man had pressed the plate back into place before jumping away. For now, he was prying it up again, and it was raising easily, peeling back like skin excised by some grotesque surgeon. The motion of the wing was very broken, but the man seemed to have no difficulty staying balanced. Once more, Wilson felt panic. What was he to do? No one believed him. If he tried to convince them anymore, they'd probably restrain him by force. If he asked the stewardess to sit by him, it would be, at best, only a momentary reprieve. The second she departed or, remaining, fell asleep, the man would return. Even if she stayed awake beside him, what was to keep the man from tampering with the engines on the other wing? Wilson shuddered, a coldness of dread misting along his bones. Dear God, there was nothing to be done. He twitched as across the window through which he watched the little man, the pilot's reflection, passed. The insanity of the moment almost broke him. The man and the pilot within feet of each other, both seen by him, yet not aware of one another. No, that was wrong. The little man had glanced across his shoulder as the pilot passed, as if he knew there was no need to leap off anymore, that Wilson's capacity for interfering was at an end. Wilson suddenly trembled with mind-searing rage. "I'll kill you," he thought. "You filthy little animal, I'll kill you." Outside, the engine faltered. It lasted only for a second, but in that second, it seemed to Wilson as if his heart had also stopped. He pressed against the window, staring. The man had bent the cowling plate far back and now was on his knees, poking a curious hand into the engine. "Don't!" Wilson heard the whimper of his own voice begging, "Don't!" Again, the engine failed. Wilson looked around in horror. Was everyone deaf? He raised his hand to press the button for the stewardess, then jerked it back. No! They'd lock him up, restrain him somehow. And he was the only one who knew what was happening, the only one who could help. "God!" Wilson bit his lower lip until the pain made him whimper. He twisted around again and jolted. The stewardess was hurrying down the rocking aisle. She'd heard it. He watched her fixedly and saw her glance at him as she passed his seat. She stopped three seats down the aisle. Someone else had heard. Wilson watched the stewardess as she leaned over, talking to the unseen passenger. Outside, the engine coughed again. Wilson jerked his head around and looked out with horror-pinched eyes. "Damn you!" he whined. He turned again and saw the stewardess coming back up the aisle. She didn't look alarmed. Wilson stared at her with unbelieving eyes. It wasn't possible. He twisted around to follow her swaying movement and saw her turn in at the kitchen.
"No!"
Wilson was shaking so badly now he couldn't stop. No one had heard. No one knew. Suddenly, Wilson bent over and slid his overnight bag out from under the seat. Unzipping it, he jerked out his briefcase and threw it on the carpeting. Then, reaching in again, he grabbed the oilskin envelope and straightened up. From the corners of his eyes, he saw the stewardess coming back and pushed the bag beneath the seat with his shoes, shoving the oilskin envelope beside himself. He sat there, rigidly, breath quavering in his chest, as she went by. Then he pulled the envelope into his lap and untied it. His movements were so feverish that he almost dropped the pistol. He caught it by the barrel, then clutched at the stock with white-knuckled fingers and pushed off the safety catch. He glanced outside and felt himself grow cold. The man was looking at him. Wilson pressed his shaking lips together. It was impossible that the man knew what he intended. He swallowed and tried to catch his breath. He shifted his gaze to where the stewardess was handing some pills to the passenger ahead, then looked back at the wing. The man was turning to the engine once again, reaching in. Wilson's grip tightened on the pistol. He began to raise it. Suddenly, he lowered it. The window was too thick. The bullet might be deflected and kill one of the passengers. He shuddered and stared out at the little man. Again, the engine failed, and Wilson saw an eruption of sparks cast light across the man's animal features. He braced himself. There was only one answer. He looked down at the handle of the emergency door. There was a transparent cover over it. Wilson pulled it free and dropped it. He looked outside. The man was still there, crouched and probing at the engine with his hand. Wilson sucked in trembling breath. He put his left hand on the door handle and tested. It wouldn't move downward. Upward, there was play. Abruptly, Wilson let go and put the pistol in his lap. No time for argument, he told himself. With shaking hands, he buckled the seatbelt across his thighs. When the door was opened, there would be a tremendous rushing out of air. For the safety of the ship, he must not go with it. Now, Wilson picked the pistol up again, his heartbeat staggering. He'd have to be sudden, accurate. If he missed, the man might jump onto the other wing, worse, onto the tail assembly where, inviolate, he would rupture wires, mangle flaps, destroy the balance of the ship. No, this was the only way. He'd fire low and try to hit the man in the chest or stomach. Wilson filled his lungs with air. Now, he thought. Now! The stewardess came up the aisle as Wilson started, pulling at the handle.
For a moment, frozen in her steps, she couldn't speak. A look of stupefied horror distended her features, and she raised one hand as if imploring him. Then suddenly, her voice shrilling above the noise of the engines, "Mr. Wilson, no! Get back!" cried Wilson, and he wrenched the handle up. The door seemed to disappear. One second, it was by him, in his grip. The next, with a hissing roar, it was gone. And the same instant, Wilson felt himself enveloped by a monstrous suction which tried to tear him from his seat. His head and shoulders left the cabin, and suddenly he was breathing tenuous, freezing air. For a moment, eardrums almost bursting from the thunder of the engines, eyes blinded by the Arctic winds, he forgot the man. It seemed he heard a prick of screaming in the maelstrom that surrounded him, a distant shout. Then Wilson saw the man. He was walking across the wing, gnarled form, leaning forward, talon-twisted hands outstretched in eagerness. Wilson flung his arm up, fired. The explosion was like a popping in the roaring violence of the air. The man staggered, lashed out, and Wilson felt a streak of pain across his head. He fired again, at immediate range, and saw the man go flailing backward, then suddenly disappear with no more solidity than a paper doll swept in a gale. Wilson felt a bursting numbness in his brain. He felt the pistol torn from failing fingers. Then all was lost in winter darkness. He stirred and mumbled. There was a warmness trickling in his veins. His limbs felt wooden. In the darkness he could hear a shuffling sound, a delicate swirl of voices. He was lying face up on something, moving, joggling. A cold wind sprinkled on his face. He felt the surface tilt beneath him. He sighed. The plane was landed, and he was being carried off on a stretcher. His head wound, likely, plus an injection to quiet him. "Nuttiest way of trying to commit suicide I ever heard of," said a voice somewhere. Wilson felt the pleasure of amusement. Whoever spoke was wrong, of course, as would be established soon enough when the engine was examined and they checked his wound more closely. Then they'd realize that he'd saved them all. Wilson slept without dreams.
The Flying Machine by Ambrose Bierce. Although Bierce lived into the age of flight, he died in 1914, one doubts if he ever actually flew. The vignette that follows is less about airplanes than it is about the gullibility of people willing to invest in them, and it certainly helps to explain his nickname, which was Bitter Bierce. My own favorite Bierce bon mot: war is God's way of teaching Americans geography.
The Flying Machine, read by Norbert Leo Butz.
An ingenious man who had built a flying machine invited a great concourse of people to see it go up. At the appointed moment, everything being ready, he boarded the car and turned on the power. The machine immediately broke through the massive substructure upon which it was builded and sank out of sight into the earth, the aeronaut springing out barely in time to save himself. "Well," said he, "I have done enough to demonstrate the correctness of my details. The defects," he added, with a look at the ruined brickwork, "are merely basic and fundamental." Upon this assurance, the people came forward with subscriptions to build a second machine.
Lucifer by E.C. Tubb. Here's the thing about air travel. Once the plane takes off, you're in it for the duration. Tubb combines that simple, irrefutable fact with an extremely original and sinister time travel concept. To say more would spoil this nasty, chilling, one-of-a-kind story. Edwin Charles Tubb was one of Great Britain's most prolific science fiction writers. In a career spanning almost 60 years, he wrote at least 150 novels and over a dozen short story collections. He edited the 1956-57 issue of Authentic Science Fiction and, under a variety of pseudonyms, wrote most of the stories himself, including the book review column. Lucifer is one of his best. It received a special award for Best Short Story at the first Eurocon in 1972.
Lucifer, read by Simon Jones.
It was a device of great social convenience, and everyone used it. Everyone in this case meaning the special people, all of whom were rich, charming, and socially successful. Those who had dropped in to study an amusing primitive culture, and those who, for personal reasons, preferred to remain on a world where they could be very large fish in a very small sea. The special people. Dilettantes of the intergalactic set, protected and cosseted by their science, playing their games with the local natives, and careful always to preserve their anonymity. But accidents can happen even to the superhuman. Stupid things, which because of their low order of probability, were statistically impossible. Like a steel cable snapping when the safe it was supporting hung 20 feet above the ground. The safe fell, smashing the sidewalk, but doing no other damage. The cable, suddenly released from strain, snapped like a whip, the end jerking in a random motion impossible to predict. The odds against it hitting any one particular place were astronomical. The odds against one of the special people being in just that spot at that exact time were so high as to negate normal probability. But it happened. The frayed end of the cable hit a skull, shredding bone, brain, and tissue in an ungodly mess. A surgically implanted mechanism sent out a distress call. The man's friends received the signal. Frank Weston got the body. Frank Weston. Anachronism. In a modern age, no man should have to drag a twisted foot through 28 years of his life, especially when he has the face of a Renaissance angel. But if he looked like an angel, he was a fallen one. The dead couldn't be hurt, but their relatives could. Tell a suicide's father that his dead girl was pregnant. A doting mother that the apple of her eye was loathsomely diseased. They didn't bother to check, why should they? And even if they did, so what? Anyone could make a mistake, and he was a morgue attendant, not a doctor. Dispassionately, he examined the new delivery. The cable had done a good job of ruining the face. Visual identification was impossible. Blood had ruined the suit, but enough remained to show the wearer had bought pricey material. The wallet contained few bills, but a lot of credit cards. There was some loose change. A cigarette case, a cigarette lighter, keys, wristwatch, type-in. They made little rustling noises as Frank fed them into an envelope. He paused when he saw the ring. Sometimes, in his job, an unscrupulous man could make a little on the side. Frank had no scruples, only defensive caution. The ring could have been lost before the stiff arrived in his care. The hand was caked with blood, and maybe no one had noticed it. Even if they had, it would be his word against theirs. If he could get it off, wash the hand free of blood, stash it away, and act innocent, the ring would be his. And he would get it off if he had to smash the hand to do it. Accidents sometimes made strange injuries. An hour later, they arrived to claim the body. Quiet men, two of them. Neatly dressed and calmly determined. The dead man was their business associate. They gave his name and address, the description of the suit he was wearing, other information. There was no question of crime and no reason to hold the body. One of them looked sharply at Frank. Is this all he had on him? That's right, said Frank. You've got it all. Sign here and he's yours. One moment. The two men looked at each other. Then the one who had spoken turned to Frank. Our friend wore a ring. It was something like this. He extended his hand. The ring had a stone and a wide band. Could we have it, please? Frank was stubborn. I haven't got it. I haven't even seen it. He wasn't wearing it when he came in here. Again, the silent conference. The ring has no intrinsic value, but it does have sentimental worth. I would be prepared to pay $100 for it, and no questions will be asked. Why tell me? Said Frank coldly. Inside, he felt a growing warmth that stemmed from sadistical pleasure. How, he didn't know, but he was hurting this man. You gonna sign or what? He turned the knife. You think I stole something, you call the cops. Either way, get out of here. In the dog hours, he examined what he had stolen. Sitting hunched in his usual corner of the canteen, masked by a newspaper, to the others in the place, just another part of the furniture. Slowly he turned the ring. The band was thick and wide, raised in one part, a prominence which could be flattened by the pressure of a finger. The stone was flat, dull, probably a poorly ground specimen of the semi-precious group. The metal could have been plated alloy. If it was, $100 could buy any of a dozen like it. But would a man dressed as the stiff had been dressed wear such a ring? The corpse had reeked of money. The cigarette case and lighter had been of jeweled platinum, too hot to think of stealing. The credit cards would have taken him around the world, and first class all the way. Would a man like that wear a lousy $100 ring? Blankly, he stared across the canteen. Facing his table, three men sat over their coffee. One of them straightened, rose, stretched, and headed towards the door. Scowling Frank dropped his eyes to the ring. Had he thrown away $100 for the sake of some junk? His fingernail touched the protuberance. It sank a little, and impatiently he pressed it flush. Nothing happened. Nothing aside from the fact that the man who had risen from the facing table and who had walked towards the door was suddenly sitting at the table again. As Frank watched, he rose, stretched, and walked towards the door. Frank pressed the stud. Nothing happened. Literally, nothing. He frowned and tried again. Abruptly, the man was back at his table. He rose, stretched, headed towards the door. Frank pressed the stud and held it down, counting. 57 seconds, and suddenly the man was back at his table again. He rose, stretched, headed towards the door. This time Frank let him go. He knew now what it was he had. He leaned back, filled with the wonder of it. Of the special people he knew nothing, but his own race had bred scientists, and even though a sadist, Frank was no fool. A man would want to keep something like this to himself. He would need to have it close to hand at all times. It would need to be in a form where he could use it quickly. So what better than a ring? Compact? Ornamental? Probably everlasting? A one-way time machine. Luck, the fortuitous combination of favorable circumstances. But who needs luck when they know what is going to happen 57 seconds in advance? Call it a minute. Not long. Try holding your breath that long. Try resting your hand on a red-hot stove for even half that time. In a minute, you can walk 100 yards, run a quarter of a mile, fall 3. You can conceive, die, get married. 57 seconds is enough for a lot of things. For a card to turn, a ball to settle, a pair of dice tumble to rest. Frank was a sure-fire winner, and in more ways than one. He stretched, enjoyed the shower, the impact of hot water driven at high pressure. He turned a control and gasped as the water turned to ice and made goose pimples rise on his skin. A cold bath in winter is hardship when you have no choice. A pleasant titivation when you have. He jerked the control back to hot, waited, then cut the spray and stepped from the shower, drying himself on a fluffy towel. "Frank, darling, are you going to be much longer?" A female voice with the peculiar intonation of the inbred upper classes, a member of the aristocracy by marriage and birth. The Lady Jane Smith Connors was rich, curious, bored, and impatient. "A moment, honey," he called, and dropped the towel. Smiling, he looked down at himself. Money had taken care of the twisted foot. Money had taken care of a lot of other things. His clothes, his accent, the education of his tastes. He was still a fallen angel, but there was bright new guilt on his broken wings. "Frank, darling!"
"Coming!"
His jaws tightened until the muscles ached. The high-toned, high-stepping bitch. She'd fallen for his face and reputation and was going to pay for her curiosity. But that could wait. First, the spider had to get the fly well and truly in his web. A silk robe to cover his nakedness, brushes to tidy his hair, a spray gave insurance against halitosis. The stallion was almost ready to perform. The bathroom had a window. He drew the curtains and looked at the night. Way down low, a scatter of lights carpeted the misty ground. London was a nice city. England a nice place. Very nice, especially to gamblers. They paid no tax on winnings. And here, more than anywhere, high prizes were to be won. Not just for cash, that was for plebeians, but make the right connections, and every day would be Christmas. London, a city the special people held in high regard. "Frank!" Impatience, irritation, arrogance. The woman waited to be served. She was tall with a peculiar angularity, an overgrown schoolgirl who should be wearing tweeds and carrying a hockey stick. But the appearance was deceptive. Generations of inbreeding had done more than fashion the distribution of flesh and bone. It had developed a ripe decadence and created a mass of seething frustrations. She was clinically insane. But in her class, people were never thought insane, only eccentric. Never stupid, only thoughtless. Never spiteful or cruel, only amusing. He reached out, took her in his arms, pressed the ball of each thumb against her eyes. She strained back from the sudden pain. He pressed harder, and she screamed from agony and the stomach-wrenching fear of blindness. In his mind, a mental clock counted seconds. 51. 52. His fingers clamped down on the ring. "Frank!" He reached out and took her in his arms, heart still pounding from the pleasure of having inflicted pain. He kissed her with practiced skill, nibbling her gently with his teeth. He ran his hands over her body, thin material rustling as it fell from her shoulders. He bit a little harder and felt her tense. "Don't do that," she said abruptly. "I hate anyone doing that." One bad mark. Frank counted seconds as he reached for the light switch. With darkness, she squirmed, pushed herself free of his arms. "I hate the dark. Must you be like all the others?" Two bad marks. 20 seconds to go. Time for one more quick exploration. His hands groped, made contact, moved with educated determination. She sighed with pleasure. He activated the ring. "Frank!" He reached out and took her in his arms, this time making no attempt to either nibble or bite. Her clothing rustled to the floor, and the skin gleamed like pearl in the light. He looked at her, boldly admiring, and his hands moved in the way which gave her pleasure. She closed her eyes, fingernails digging into his back. "Talk to me," she demanded. "Talk to me." He began counting seconds. Later, as she lay in satiated sleep, he rested, smoking, thinking, oddly amused. He had been the perfect lover. He had said and done the exact things she wanted in the exact order she wanted them, and more important than anything else, had said and done them without her prompting him at any time. He had been a reflection of herself, an echo of her needs, and why not? He had worked hard to map the blueprint of her desires. exploring, investigating, erasing all false starts and mistakes. What else could he have been but perfect? He turned, looking down at the woman, seeing her not as flesh and blood, but as the rung of a ladder leading to acceptance. Frank Weston had come a long way. He intended to keep climbing. She sighed, opened her eyes, looked at the classical beauty of his face.
"Darling."
He said what she wanted him to say. She sighed again, same sound, different meaning.
"I'll see you tonight."
"No."
"Frank!"
Jealousy reared her upright. "Why not?
You said—"
"I know what I said, and I meant every word of it," he interrupted. "But I have to fly to New York. Business," he added. "After all, I do have to make a living." She caught the bait.
"You don't have to worry about that. I'll speak to Daddy, and—"
He closed her lips with his own. "I still have to go," he insisted. Beneath the covers, his hands did what she wanted them to do. "And when I return—"
"I'll get a divorce," she said. "We'll be married."
Christmas, he thought, as dawn paled the sky. "Come fly with me," said the song, "me being a gleaming new comet. Two stewardesses, all legs and eyes and silken hair, with a 'you may look at me because I'm beautiful, but you must never, ever touch' attitude. A flight crew and 73 other passengers, only 18 of which were travelling first class. Room for everyone, and Frank was glad of it. He felt tired. The night had been hectic, and the morning no better. It was good to sit and relax, neatly strapped in a form-fitting chair, as the jets gulped air and spewed it behind, in a man-made hurricane which sent the plane down the runway and up into the sky. London fell away to one side, the clouds dropped like tufts of dirty cotton, and then there was only the sun, a watchful eye in an immense iris of blue. "Go west, young man," he thought smugly. Why? For no reason other than he liked to travel, and a little absence could make a heart grow fonder. And there was a kick in flying. He liked to look down and think of all the emptiness between him and the ground, feel his stomach tighten with acrophobia, the delicious sensation of fear experienced in perfect safety. Height had no meaning in a plane. All you had to do was to look straight ahead, and you could be in a Pullman. He unstrapped, stretched his legs, glanced through a window as the captain's voice came over the speakers, telling him that they were flying at a height of 34,000 feet at a speed of 536 miles per hour. Through the window he could see very little. The sky, the clouds below, the tip of a quivering sheet of metal which was a wing. Old stuff. The blonde stewardess was far from that. She swayed down the aisle, caught his eyes, responded with instant attention. Was he quite comfortable? Would he like a pillow? A newspaper? A magazine? Something to drink? Brandy, he said, with ice and soda. He sat on the inner seat close to the wall of the cabin, so that she had to step from the aisle in order to lower the flap and set out his drink. He lifted his left hand and touched her knee, slid the hand up the inside of her thigh, felt her stiffen, saw the expression on her face. It was a compound of incredulity, outrage, interest, and speculation. It didn't last long. His right hand reached out and dug fingers into her throat. Congested blood purpled her cheeks, eyes popped, the discarded tray made a mess as her hands fluttered in helpless anguish. Within his mind, the automatic clock counted off the seconds. 52, 53, 54. He pressed the stud on his ring. The flap made a little thudding noise as it came to rest, the brandy a liquid gurgling as it gushed from a miniature bottle over the ice. She smiled, poising the punctured can of soda. "All of it, sir?" He nodded, watching as she poured, remembering the soft warmth of her thigh, the touch of her flesh. Did she know that he had almost killed her? Could she possibly guess? No, he decided as she moved away. How could she? To her, nothing had happened. She had served him a drink, and that was all. That was all, but... Brooding, he stared at the ring. You activated it.
and went back 57 seconds in time. All you had done during that period was erased. You could kill, rob, commit mayhem, and none of it mattered, because none of it had happened. But it had happened. It could be remembered. Could you remember what had never taken place? That girl, for example. He had felt her thigh, the warm place between her legs, the yielding softness of her throat. He could have poked out her eyes, doubled her screaming, mutilated her face. He had done that, and more, to others. Pandering to his sadism, his love of inflicting pain. And he had killed. But what was killing when you could undo the inconvenience of your crime? When you could watch the body smile and walk away? The plane rocked a little. The voice from the speaker was calm, unhurried. "Will all passengers please fasten their safety belts? We are heading into an area of minor disturbance. You may see a little lightning, but there is absolutely nothing to worry about. We are, of course, flying well above the area of storm." Frank ignored the instruction, still engrossed with the ring. The unpolished stone looked like a dead eye, suddenly malevolent, somehow threatening. Irritably, he finished his drink. The ring was nothing but a machine. The blonde passed down the aisle, tutted when she saw his unfastened belt, made to tighten it. He waved her away, fumbled with the straps, let the belt fall open. He didn't need it and didn't like it. Frowning, he settled back, thinking. Time. Was it a single line, or one with many branches? Could it be that each time he activated the ring, an alternate universe was created? That somewhere was a world in which he had attacked the stewardess and had to pay for the crime? But he had only attacked her because he'd known he could erase the incident. Without the ring, he wouldn't have touched her. With the ring, he could do as he liked, because he could always go back and escape the consequences. Therefore, the alternate universe theory couldn't apply. What did? He didn't know, and it didn't matter. He had the ring, and that was enough. The ring they had offered a lousy $100 for. Something hit the roof of the cabin. There was a ripping sound, a blast of air, an irresistible force which tore him from his seat and flung him into space. Air gushed from his lungs as he began to fall. He gulped, trying to breathe, to understand. Arctic cold numbed his flesh. He twisted, saw through streaming eyes the plane with one wing torn loose, the metal tearing free as he watched, the plane accompanying his fall to the sea 5 miles below. An accident, he thought wildly. A fireball. A meteor. Metal fatigue, even. A crack in the cabin wall and internal pressure would do the rest. Now he was falling. Falling! His fingers squeezed in frenzied reaction. "Please, Mr. Weston." The blonde stewardess came forward as he reared from his seat. "You must remain seated and with your safety belt fastened. Unless..." Diplomatically, she looked towards the toilets at the rear of the cabin. "Listen!" He grabbed her by both arms. "Tell the pilot to change course. Tell him now. Hurry!" A fireball or a meteor could be dodged that way. They could find safety if the course was changed fast enough, but it had to be fast. Fast! "Quick!" He ran towards the flight deck, the girl at his heels. "Damn the stupid bitch. Couldn't she understand?" "This is an emergency," he shouted. "The pilot must change course immediately." Something hit the roof of the cabin. The compartment popped open, metal coiling like the peeled skin of a banana. The blonde vanished. The shriek of tearing metal was lost in the explosive gusting of escaping air. Desperately, Frank clung to a seat, felt his hands being torn from the fabric, his body sucked towards the opening. Once again, he was ejected into space to begin the long, stomach-twisting 5-mile fall. "No!" he screamed, frantic with terror. "Dear God, no!" He activated. "Mr. Weston, I really must insist. If you do not want to go to the toilet, you must allow me to fasten your safety belt." He was standing by his seat, and the blonde was showing signs of getting annoyed. Annoyed! "This is important," he said, fighting to remain calm. "In less than a minute, this plane is going to fall apart. Do you understand? We are all going to die unless the pilot changes course immediately." Why did she have to stand there looking so dumb? He had told her all this before. "You stupid cow! Get out of my way!" He pushed her to one side and lunged again towards the flight deck. He tripped, fell, came raging to his feet. "Change course!" he yelled. For God's sake, listen, and... Something hit the roof. Again, the roar, the blast, the irresistible force. Something struck his head, and he was well below the clouds before he managed to regain full control. He activated, and found himself still in space, gulping at rarefied air and shivering with savage cold. To one side, the shattered plane hung as though suspended, a mass of disintegrating debris as it fell. Tiny fragments hung around it, one of them perhaps the blonde. The clouds passed. Below, the sea spread in a shimmer of light and water. His stomach constricted with overwhelming terror as he stared at the waves, his lurking acrophobia aroused and tearing at every cell. Hitting the sea would be like smashing into a floor of solid concrete, and he would be conscious to the very end. Spasmodically, he activated and immediately was high in the air again, with almost a minute of grace in which to fall. 57 seconds of undiluted hell. Repeated. 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 Over and over. Because the alternative was to smash into the waiting sea.
The Fifth Category by Tom Bissell. Tom Bissell is one of America's best and most interesting, they are not always the same, writers. In addition to nonfiction, such as the book-length Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter, he has written scripts for video games such as Gears of War and co-wrote the critically acclaimed The Disaster Artist, My Life Inside the Room, the greatest bad movie ever made, which became an award-winning film starring and directed by James Franco. Bissell, who has covered the Gulf Wars as a journalist, has also found time to write some extraordinary short stories. This tale of the author of several controversial legal memos awakening on a deserted airliner on a flight from Estonia is one of his best.
The Fifth Category. Read by Norbert Leo Butz.
John woke statically electric from some unremembered dream. He recalibrated with Gatling blinks, his brain malnourished. Falling asleep on a plane was like paying someone to assault you in the middle of the night. Oddly, though, he did not remember falling asleep. For that matter, he did not remember wanting to fall asleep. His last memory, drinking a Diet Coke, chatting with his neighbor, Janneke, a tall Estonian woman with a mischievous wood sprite face, who said she was on her way to the United States for her first visit. John certainly did not remember pulling the blanket up to his chin or inserting behind his head the wondrously soft pillow he felt there. And he would have remembered. A bedtime habit of his, dating from childhood, was putting a memory lock on his sleeping position. The spoon, the scissor, the dead man, the fetus, the sprawl, just before the final fade. Only twice in his life had he found himself in the same position upon waking. John thought of sleep as a form of time travel. Things happened, mental labors occurred, body parts moved, and you would never know. Janneke was gone, and the darkened plane was now over the mid-Atlantic, he guessed. She probably left for a stretch. Europeans in their in-flight calisthenics, their applause on landing. The cabin's every lozenge-shaped window shade had been pulled down. The only illumination was provided by the glowing orange ellipses of the cabin's running lights. John lifted his window shade. What he saw could not be. His flight landed in New York at 4 p.m. It was not a night flight. And yet, outside, night. Janneke's seat, John now realized, was not the only vacant one. The remaining 40-odd business-class seats were also empty. He lunged for a seatbelt. The cozily paired thrones of business class were spread spaciously throughout the cabin, and no overhead luggage compartments hindered his movement around them. Many were draped with twisty blankets. Others had headphones still plugged into their armrest jacks. Half a dozen pillows littered the floor. Carry-ons remained stuffed under a number of seats. One aisle over, someone had left the seat tray extended, and on it sat a perfume-sized bottle of red wine and a plastic glass. Hovering above every seat was the same sense of sudden abandonment. Something had happened, he thought, that gathered everyone's attention back in coach. A drunken Finn punching out a flight attendant, a heart attack. He drew a crisp mental X, for now, through any other possibilities. John whipped aside the thin blue curtain that allowed those in coach merely to imagine their deprivation. His hand sought the steadying reality of the gray, white-speckled partition from which the curtain hung. Before him spanned 30 darkened rows of unfilled seats. Out of shock, he took a single step forward. He reached for his iPhone, sensing its absence before his hand even touched his pocket. Despite the darkness, he saw a few crude shapes on the first row of seats. Paperbacks, newspapers, a briefcase. It grew darker the deeper into the rows he walked, as though he were entering a synthetic jungle. How fundamentally wrong it felt to run down the narrow aisle of a commercial aircraft. When he reached the tight, dark aft quarters, he felt trapped in a bewilderingly unfamiliar closet. His hands fumbled for the braille of the visible world. The attendants' jump seats were up. Adjacent to one of them was a mounted flashlight, which he pulled from its cradle. He slashed a blade of light across the kitchen, its long silver drawers looking like they belonged in a submarine, and over an unloaded dinner cart pushed into the kitchen's deepest recess. He turned, the light passing an overhead container marked first aid, then brought the beam to bear on one of the plane's exit doors, an immense thing, less like a door than an igloo's facade. Out of its tiny porthole, John saw layers of wing-sliced clouds swirl in the starless night. He turned to the attendant's control panel, complicated by numerous knobs and buttons. Even though it was a Finnair flight, everything was in English. At the bottom of the panel was a red evac button. He worked his way up past several call buttons, all dark. A small green screen glowing with utterly unfathomable information. A public announcement button, and finally, the lighting panel, which held not buttons but knobs, all of which he began turning. In the harsh new light, he opened the door to the lavatory, half expecting to find a magically immense room in which the several hundred people who boarded this flight were waiting with pointy party hats and confetti. But it was empty, shockingly white, and smelled of shit and spearmint. Transparent blisters of standing water adorned the sink's metal basin. He charged back up coach, through business class, and found himself at the cockpit door, which had a thick, reinforced look. Hardened was the technical term, he believed. How to proceed was unclear. Any display of forcefulness so close to the pilot seemed to John both unwise and potentially unlawful. So he knocked. When no one answered, he attempted to open it. Locked. He knocked again. He noticed a small knee-level cabinet. Inside were four yellow life jackets and some kind of heavy steel air compressor. He looked at the four's exit door, another glacial immensity he was not sure he could figure out how to open if he tried. But why would he want to? That he was already considering this a possible exit did not, he realized, bode particularly well. He was sweating now. His body, as though having at last accepted, analyzed, and rejected the information his mind had sent forth, began some pointless counterattack. From his stomach, the staging area, his body spit his most recent meal into his intestinal coils. He stood there, clenched, listening to his heart pump, his lungs fill and empty. The curtain hanging between voluntary and involuntary function had been torn from its runners. His nervous system seemed a single concentration lapse from going offline. He pounded on the cockpit door, shouting that something had happened, that he needed help. When, finally, he stopped, his forehead came to rest against the door's hardened outer shell. His breath was as sour and microbial as a petri dish. He felt weak, white-bellied, and exposed. He then heard something on the door's other side and jumped back. Slowly, he closed back in, fitting his ear within the cup his hand formed against the cold metal. On the other side of the door, in the cockpit of a plane with no passengers, someone was weeping. He had been advised not to travel outside the United States by his lawyer, his sympathetic university colleagues. He had more than most would have guessed. John was nothing, if not the soul of faculty meeting affability. And those few from justice to whom he still spoke. But when an invitation to speak at a conference, International Law and the Future of American-European Relations, in Tallinn, Estonia, was first extended 6 months ago, John did what he always did. He talked to his wife. One of the things he appreciated most about leaving government service was that he could, once again, talk to his wife about work. Anyone who lived within his mind to the degree that John did asked for nothing more perfect than a companion able to step inside that mind when invited and leave before asking was necessary. For the last 2 years, she had been his confidant, sentinel, nurse, and ballast. It was, nevertheless, one of his marriage's longer, more difficult nights, when a number of his so-called torture memos were leaked and then, without any warning to him, declassified and disavowed. His wife was not the only person with whom he had proved able to clarify his intentions in writing the memos. Any journalist who took the time to see John invariably came away admitting that the purported werewolf seemed a decent enough sort. After telling his wife about the conference invitation, he admitted, "My first thought was to say no, but I think I may want to go." 2 years ago, a complaint accusing John of war crimes had been filed in a German court. The gears of this particular justice had since scarcely turned. Another suit was filed 6 months ago in a California court by a convicted American terrorist and his mother, who claimed John's memos had led to his maltreatment while in U.S. custody. John did not dispute, though of course could not admit, that the wretch had been poorly treated in custody, but drawing the line back to him evidenced a kind of naive legal creationism. While John's travel was by no means formally restricted, the thought of leaving American airspace filled him with unfamiliar apprehension. This shocked him. It also emboldened him. "Don't route your flight through Germany," his wife said. "Or France. Or Spain. I'd avoid Italy, too, for that matter." She thought he was joking about wanting to go, he realized, and he waited a moment before telling her what he liked about Estonia, a young country with memories of actual oppression. He had always been interested in the nations of the former Soviet bloc and post-communist countries in general. His parents' flight from Korean communism was, after all, the only reason he was an American. He did not think he had any cause to fear Estonia, which was an official American ally in the war. Was his wife aware that there were only 1 million Estonians in the world? Maybe it was a Korean thing, but he felt a strange kinship with small, frequently invaded, routinely pushed around nations. He admired, he said somewhat grandly, their parochial ambitions. He was now shamelessly appealing to his wife's own complicated feelings concerning her Vietnamese heritage. She asked how he could be certain it was not simply a trap to publicly humiliate him. To that he already had something of an answer. The event's organizers had promised, unprompted, that no topics would be discussed beyond John's willingness to discuss them. They were aware of the lawsuits and promised him full escape pod capability during any line of questioning. Escape pod. His words, not theirs. Like any nerd who grew up in the 1970s, John was always good for a Star Wars reference. The U.S. Embassy, moreover, was aware of John's invitation. Aware of. Their words, not his. A middling embassy like Estonia's was no doubt heavily staffed with administration flunkies and professional vacationists. Given that John was the only former member of the administration who insisted on talking about the decisions he had made while part of it, he was as popular among them as a leper bell. "But you'll talk about it all anyway," she said, "won't you?" John often reduced his lawyer to similar frustration. He was not afraid to defend himself, provided his interlocutor was not obviously carrying a torch and kindling. After John had granted an interview to Esquire, his lawyer did not speak to him for a week. Then his lawyer read the not entirely unflattering profile that resulted. "You're a smooth one, counsel," he told John. John smiled at his wife. Of course he would talk about it all. He knew what he could say and could not say. He was a lawyer. When he told the event's organizers he would be able to come, they expressed as much surprise as excitement. He would be the only American, they said, and as such, an invaluable part of the discussion. It was agreed he would speak alone at the close of the conference for an hour, and then answer questions, some of which, they warned, might be hostile. "It all sounded fine," John emailed back. He had faced more bloodthirsty rooms than he imagined Estonia could muster. Before agreeing, he checked in with the embassy and Tallinn. They acknowledged the conference and wished him a successful trip. The last he would hear from them, he suspected. 6 months later, he spent 2 hours laid over in Helsinki's airport. When two Finnish security guards stopped near John's exit to chat, he was not sure why he felt so nervous. It was not as if Interpol had issued a warrant for his arrest. But what man could truly relax knowing that courts on two continents entertained the possibility he had committed crimes against humanity? He supposed he was brave for being here. No, actually. This thought disgusted him. He was a teacher and a lawyer in that order. He did not recall the last time he raised his voice. He did not recall once in his 4 decades having intentionally hurt anyone. The Finnish guards walked away. He boarded the flight to Tallinn with re-energized anonymity. By the time he saw his spired, red-roofed seaside destination appear outside the starboard window, he knew he had made the right choice. It was noon by the time he reached his hotel in Tallinn's old town. Checking in was surreally pleasant. The conference's organizers had sent flowers. He called them to ask for directions to that night's conference hall, which, as it happened, was less than 3 blocks away, in another hotel, the Viru. "No, no thank you," he could make his way there on his own. His talk was scheduled for 8 p.m. This meant he had an afternoon to spend in Tallinn. He did so by sleeping off the circadian catastrophe of shooting across 10 time zones. By 5 o'clock, he was awake, showered, dressed in a cement-colored suit with a blue shirt, no tie, and wandering Tallinn's old town in search of dinner. The organizers had offered to send someone, but no. He wanted to announce his conference presence with the same powerful abruptness he used to enter his classrooms. If any of the conference's participants were indeed seeking to confront him, the fewer pressure points with which they had time to acquaint themselves, the better. The charms of Tallinn's old town were myriad and entirely preposterous. No actual human beings could live here. It looked like a soundstage for some elvish epic. The streets, the most furiously cobbled he had ever seen, appeared to shed their names at every intersection. Most took him past pubs, restaurants, shops selling amber, and nothing else. It was easy to distinguish the tourists from the locals. Everyone not working was a tourist. Outside a medieval restaurant off the town square, young Estonians dressed like the maidens and squires of the Hanseatic League watched as their co-workers reenacted a sword fight. On one block-long side street, a blast of methane wind took hold of him, The sewage coursing through 300-year-old plumbing was one bit of Tallinn's past in no need of recreation. The similarity of the old town's many ornate black church spires confused him. Every time he settled on one as his compass back toward the Viru, he realized it was the wrong tower. For 2 hours, he was always at least slightly lost. From its height and brutalist design, he correctly surmised that the Viru had once been the in-tourist hotel during the Soviet era. In its lobby, he found a wall of fame listing some of the hotel's notable guests. Olympians, musicians, actors, Arab princes, and the president himself. A note written to the hotel manager on White House letterhead was framed. Thanks also for the good-looking sweater and hat. After inquiries at the front desk, an elevator ride to the conference floor, and an olfactory napalming courtesy of a perfumed woman riding up with him, John walked down a lushly carpeted hallway toward the registration desk. The young man sitting there pointed further down the hall, toward a small group of people politely waiting outside the conference room proper for the current speaker to finish. John was on in half an hour. He joined the waiting listeners outside the conference room, a golden and chandeliered cavern. The speaker was German. From the translation projected onto a screen behind the woman, in French, Estonian, and English, he too had been asked to send the text of his talk beforehand to the organizers, after extracting from them a promise that native English speakers would translate it. John knew he was in for a slightly rougher night than he had been anticipating. He had heard all the tropes of the German woman's talk before. She finished to applause and answered questions, after which a 10-minute break was announced. As people rose from their seats, another woman near the back of the room turned, spotted John, and with a smile of recognition, walked toward him. John met her halfway, maneuvering through the human cross-stream of intermission. This was Ylvi, one of the organizers, his contact, and a professor of law at the University of Tartu. A very young professor of law, which warmed the still youthful-looking John to her instantly. They shook, after which Ylvi began nodding her hands as though shaping a small clay ball. Pleasantries, then. Flights, sleep, Tallinn. She asked, "Are you ready?" John laughed and said he thought so. She laughed too, her enamel giving off a slight yellow tinge. Ylvi had chapped lips and a mushroom of curly brown hair. Her long and angular face was almost cubist, its unusual prettiness cohering only after you spent some time looking at her. For some incomprehensible reason, Ylvi guided John to the German speaker who had just finished condemning his country. She was speaking to 4 people at once, all of whom stood around her. She appeared accustomed to being the center of attention. They appeared accustomed to providing it. These conferences were all the same. Attendees may as well have been given scripts and assigned parts. At Ylvi's announcement of John's name, they all turned to consider him. He smiled, his hand thrust out. Only one person, an older man wearing a heavy wool sport coat, deigned to shake, though he did so with the dutiful air of a prisoner meeting his warden. John's smile was now a dying man's attempt at serenity. No one said anything after that. For far longer than John appreciated, Ylvi, whether more